I'm just making it up. So anyway, my name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and the mission and the work I do is to empower people to make informed food choices, to debunk myths about veganism and animal rights, and to give people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I always say that I'm not asking people to live according to my values. I'm urging people to live according to their own values. And I believe that people really want to make this change. I really believe that people are desperate to make changes that reflect their values. The problem is we live in a culture that doesn't exactly make it easy for us to make the most healthful choices. We live in a culture that actually makes it really difficult for us to do so. We live in a culture that makes it difficult for us to live according to our own values and make the most compassionate choices as well. So there's a lot of information on why vegan, and I believe that people are coming at it from a lot of different places, and that's fantastic. But what I do is really the how vegan. I really guide people to make this transition, to do it joyfully, to do it healthfully, and to do it confidently. With the culture, the way it's set up, there are so many myths and misconceptions about living compassionately and living healthfully, and those myths become legends for people. And I think though people really are concerned about certain things, and that's why I do what I do and I'm happy to do it, I think these myths also wind up becoming excuses for people, and we wind up using these things as blocks that actually stop us from making the changes we really do want to make. And those blocks could be around food, they could be around nutrition, they could be around the social aspects, the ethical aspects, the animals, all of the myths that we tell ourselves. So what I want to talk about today are some of these myths. Specifically around nutrition, food, and the social aspects. I know it's a little wonky, isn't it? I know. I don't know what to do. Okay. I know, but they told me to put two on. I don't know what to do. Who shall I see? Is there anything to do? This is going to be annoying for 45 minutes. Which microphone is this for? That's for the room. And this is for the... So if I see it's too low, you won't be able to hear me. You won't be able to... What's that? And then... You're saying that one's not doing anything to the sound. It's really this one that's... I'm so sorry. I don't know what to do. I know. I'm sorry. Okay. Boo! Okay. Get her off! Okay, so I'll try and just make it as comfortable as possible. So starting with the nutrition aspects, that's obviously one of the big myths that we have. You know, the first question every vegan or every vegetarian is asked is... That's so interesting. You know that question. Where do you get your protein? So the problem is, the first question that we get is, where do you get your protein? And what I really want to emphasize is the problem is not where vegans are getting their protein. The problem is that we've all been taught that we need to go through an animal to get to the nutrients that are in the plants that the animals are eating and that we're trying to get when we eat the animals. In other words, the nutrients we need are plant-based. The nutrients we need are not animal-based. And we've all been taught that the nutrients we need are animal-based. If I were to ask you where we're supposed to get, where we're taught we're supposed to get our calcium from, you would say cow's milk. If I were to ask you where we're taught we should get our omega-3 fatty acids from, you would say fish, and protein, meat, eggs, all the animal products. So that is so annoying. That door keeps slamming. So we're taught that we're supposed to get our nutrients from the animals. And when we do so, we're trying to get the nutrients we want. But in the meantime, we're also getting the saturated fat. We're getting the dietary cholesterol. We're getting the animal protein that people are getting way too much of. We're getting the lactose, etc. When we skip the middle animal and go directly to the plants and get the nutrients we need from the plants, we get the phytochemicals, we get the nutrients that we want, the vitamins and minerals that we're looking for, we get the antioxidants, we get the fiber that people are just not getting. Fiber exists only in plant foods, it does not exist outside of plant foods. So we get all the good stuff and we skip all of the things that are harmful. So it's really problematic going through an animal, both from a health perspective, from, of course, a resource perspective, from an ethical perspective. And you can do this with every nutrient. You can break this down with every nutrient. I mean, if we start with calcium, which is one of the big myths that we're all told that we have to get it through cow's milk. I mean, what is calcium, first of all? What is it? It's a mineral. And where are minerals found? In the ground, in the soil. And so why do cows have a lot of calcium in their milk? is they eat the grass, because they're eating the vegetables that actually have all of the minerals in them, in the grass. Ideally, 3 out of 4 cows are not actually eating grass. They're kept on dry lots, and so they're actually not getting the calcium through the plants. So what do you think they're doing to their feed? They're supplementing it. You could supplement your feed and skip all of this, right? You could take supplements, but I mean, ideally, what I'm suggesting is we go to the plants. But the idea that we're going through an animal who's getting the calcium through supplements is incredibly resource intensive and unnecessary and ethically problematic as well, because you have to have a pregnant animal in order for her to lactate. And I know there's one person in this room who doesn't know that. I didn't know that. We're not taught to think that cows have to be pregnant in order to lactate. Our language doesn't even support that. We say cows give milk, like they come into this world ready to bestow upon us their nutritional gifts, right? We say cows give milk. We don't say we take, we certainly don't say we take their milk. We don't even say they produce milk. We don't say they lactate. We say they give milk. So we already have this notion that they're here for us. And so I remember when I first learned that cows actually have to be pregnant, I felt so stupid, because I am smart, I get biology, I know how that works, right? But I wasn't encouraged to think that way, so I had no idea. And she is pregnant, she's impregnated, she's pregnant for 9 months, and at the end of that 9 month period, all she wants is her baby. There is no animal, we do not have a corner on maternal affection and maternal desires and to nurture our young. That is across the entire animal kingdom. But she's not allowed to nurture. She's not allowed to do what is the most natural thing for her to do, because we take her babies, because we want her milk, the milk that's quite literally created for her baby. So we take her baby, and of course, we do this for her. She goes through a whole cycle of impregnation and loss through her whole 4 or 5 years that she's allowed to stay alive, until there's no longer a value in her life because she can't produce as much milk to make her profitable. So she's sent to slaughter. There is no such thing as a spa for used up dairy cows. There just isn't. And I know that a lot of people want to believe that, but nobody is going to keep these animals alive. Nobody's going to feed them and shelter them and take care of them and not make anything back in return. There is no such thing as a slaughter-free animal agriculture system, period. So she's sent to slaughter, and now you have these offspring. And what was so striking to me when I first learned about all of this is these babies are simply incidental. They exist only because she had to be pregnant in order to lactate. So you have 50% of these animals who are males and 50% female. And of course, the males have nothing to do with an industry that exploits the female reproductive system. So they're useless and worthless. And they're killed right away for Bob veal, or after 16 weeks for, I guess, regular veal, milk-fed veal. And then, of course, the females go back into the same servitude as their mother. All so that we could get the calcium that we could better get going directly to the plants. All of this, which makes absolutely no sense. And if you think about what happens to that calf when he starts to get older and he starts to grow, because it's obviously what all of this is meant to do. If he were allowed in nature to actually consume his mother's milk, what would happen as he started to get older? He would move on to solid foods, and he would get his nutrients directly from the ground. So we're taught that, right? I mean, we are weaned from human milk, right? At this point, most of us adults in our lives. So we understand the concept of that milk being there only for us to really give us the nutrients we need as we're growing and becoming strong. And it takes longer for us, but cows stop nursing a year and a half, et cetera. We stop drinking our mother's milk. The cows and the steer, they stop drinking their mother's milk. But when we're weaned, we're told that we now, no, you have to go continue drinking the milk of another species, when the offspring of that very species has stopped drinking his mother's milk. It doesn't make any sense. And if I were to suggest that we consume our own human milk into adulthood, come on! What's the problem? What's wrong? Right? So instinctively, we're like, no, we're not supposed to drink it into adulthood. That's disgusting. But we have no problem drinking the milk of another species, right? When we wouldn't even drink our own mother's milk. I mean, there's jokes about that. There's, people get disgusted if they think about, cheese made from human milk or ice cream made from human milk. People are disgusted by that. It's our own species' milk. So why? Why cow's milk? Why cow's milk? Why goat's milk? Why sheep's milk? Why buffalo milk in certain parts of the world? Why camel's milk? Why? What's so special about this group of animals, these animals' milk, that makes it so natural or healthy for humans to consume? Is there something specific in the milk that makes it so good for us? Why not hyena's milk? Hyena's milk is really high in calcium, really high in protein. Why not hyena's milk? Could it be that it has nothing to do with the nature of the milk and everything to do with the nature of these animals? That these animals are all herd animals, these animals are all vegetarian animals, and the only time they're dangerous is when you're actually trying to take their babies away? That's the only time a cow becomes dangerous, is when you're trying to separate her from her young? But otherwise, they're vegetarians, so they don't, you know, their killing instinct is pretty subdued. A hyena, on the other hand, will probably kill you if you tried to take her milk, right? So the point is, that's how arbitrary this decision is. It has nothing to do with the milk itself. Nothing. It has everything to do with the nature of the animals. And so even if you look at the nature of the milk, I mean, we're talking about absorbing 30% of the calcium from cow's milk, whereas you're absorbing 50 to 60% of the calcium when you go directly to the kale, to the bok choy, right? So skipping the middle animal has health benefits, it has the ethical benefits, it has the environmental benefits, all of it. All of it. So I recommend that we skip the middle animal, go directly to the source, to that kale, to the bok choy, to the figs, to the white beans, have high amounts of calcium, the almonds, and skip the middle animal. And you can do this with every nutrient. You can do this with omega-3 fatty acids. You said that, you know, fish is what we're taught we have to get omega-3 fatty acids from. Where do you think the fish are getting their omega-3 fatty acids from? From the algae, from the phytoplankton, from the plants, or from the plant-eating animals that the salmon are eating, because don't forget, those are carnivorous fish. So again, we could go directly to the ocean and deplete the ocean of life, which is what we're doing. We've wiped out salmon on the East Coast, and it's endangered on the West Coast. 90% of what people are eating when they eat salmon are farm-raised. So we can deplete the oceans, what we're doing, and still get the saturated fat and the dietary cholesterol and the animal protein, get some heavy metals thrown in there as well for good measure. Or we can do it through factory farming, same thing, the saturated fat, no different there. You're still getting heavy metals, because where do you think they're taking the fish from to feed the fish who are carnivores? From the ocean. So you're still getting the heavy metals because they're absorbing it into their bodies, into their fat. And then you get some pesticides and some antibiotics thrown in as well. So we have those two choices, we're always told. Or we could skip the middle fish and go directly to the plant sources and not go through all of this and do this dance to try and get what we really need properly without harming anybody. We can do that. Like, that is possible. You know, ground flax seeds are the most concentrated source of omega-3 fatty acids. You all know that. Walnuts, you know, hemp seeds, I mean, there's so many wonderful sources of omega-3 fatty acids, just fruits and vegetables. I mean, in my 30-day vegan challenge, there's a whole chapter on this, and I talk about also the need to just reduce the amount of omega-6s that we're getting and increase the amount of omega-3s. It's not just as easy as a salmon bite all the time. So there's things we can do better in terms of eating healthier and eating more whole foods to get those omega-3 fatty acids. But you can do this across the board. You can do this with, you know, protein, all of it. The nutrients we need are plant-based. You know, protein, the biggest myth, the biggest misconception. I mean, and people who come to me and ask me about protein, they always say, I tried being vegetarian, but I really needed protein. And I said, oh, well, how did that play out? What did that look like? Well, I don't know. I just really needed some protein. I said, well, how did it feel? Like, what did it feel like? I don't know. I was tired. And I said, okay, well, tired is not protein deficiency. What happened? Well, I was anemic. My doctor said, that's iron. What is the protein deficiency? They can't tell you. Most people don't know what it looks like, right? I mean, can you raise your hand, please, if you've heard of heart disease? Anybody hear of heart disease? Anybody hear of diabetes or high blood pressure, or high cholesterol? Raise your hand, please, if you know anyone with kwashiorkor. Anybody? You don't know anybody with kwashiorkor. No, you don't. Right? Do you know any kwashiorkor specialists? Any wards in the hospitals, kwashiorkor wards? You know, you've seen cardiology wards and cardiologists and cancer wards and diabetes specialists. We don't have kwashiorkor in developed nations because we don't have diseases of deficiency. Kwashiorkor is the scientific term for protein deficiency. We don't know anybody with protein deficiency. We've seen people, if we've seen late night appeals of children who have distended bellies and discolored skin, yellowing skin, you know, in hunger organizations who are appealing for to feed these children, they have kwashiorkor. they are not getting protein because they're not eating food. And the only time we really see true protein deficiency in developed nations is when they're not eating. So if someone's anorexic or if they're quite literally so sick that they're not eating. We don't have diseases of deficiency. We have diseases of excess. All of our problems have to do with what we're getting way too much of. And that's, again, the animal protein, the saturated fat, the dietary cholesterol, the lactose, etc. Right? The lactose. I mean, that one is my favorite, that people have been taught that there's something wrong with them, that they have lactose intolerance, people who say they have this disorder now, right? Our bodies stop making lactase, which is the enzyme that helps us digest that milk sugar called lactose that's in all mammalian milk. So at a certain age, we're not even supposed to be consuming any animal's milk, including our own, and our bodies prove that because we stop making lactose. And so then you hear about people who are told they have lactose intolerance like there's something wrong with them. Lactose intolerance is not a disorder. Lactose intolerance is normal. You do not have a problem if you have lactose intolerance. Only the people who can continue to digest that milk sugar, people in Scandinavia, because they're consuming so much cheese and so much cow's milk, they have lactase persistence. But you don't have lactose intolerance. We don't have it. And we're talking the majority of people around the world, okay? So the diseases that we have are diseases of excess, not deficiency. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? I just want it to make sense, right? So don't believe me. That's what I don't want people to believe me. I just want it to make sense to people, because you do not have to be a specialist in nutrition to understand that we're going through an animal to get to the nutrients we actually need. So those are some nutrition aspects, and that's in 30-Day Vegan Challenge, and I go into obviously more detail about all of them. The other aspect that people tend to have a lot of excuses around or myths around is food aspect, is kind of the whole eating aspect, and there's so many components of that. One of the things that people tend to say a lot, I don't know if it's an excuse, it's definitely a perception that they have of themselves, is they often say when they meet a vegan that they don't eat a lot of meat or dairy or eggs. I don't think I've ever met anyone who didn't say, I don't eat a lot of meat or dairy or eggs. Someone's eating this stuff. Someone is eating this stuff. I mean, someone's eating it. And we have this perception of ourselves, and then we have the reality. Because the truth is, you really don't know how much you're eating until you stop. That's really the truth. You don't really know how much you're doing of any habit until you stop. And that's the principle behind the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, is just stop long enough to experience what it's like to create new habits. And that's all this is. All of our eating is based on habit. Our food choices, the way we plate our food, the choices we make, it's all based on habit. Now, that's the good news, and it's the bad news. It's the bad news because we are fierce creatures of habit. But it's the good news because habits are meant to be broken. And I think people who try to make the transition to being vegetarian or vegan failed, as they would say, because they removed a foundation that was familiar to them, and they removed habits that were familiar to them, but didn't replace them with anything else. And that's what my work is about. That's what the 30-Day Vegan Challenge is about, is replacing your old foundation with a new one, so that you're looking in a new direction, and so that those new habits become second nature to you. That's the whole idea. And for people who are already vegan, that book is still beneficial, because it's going to give you all the ways to be able to speak to people who are coming at you with these excuses, etc. So, speaking of nature, another excuse that people tend to make around not eating animals is they often will say that they tried being vegetarian, but they really craved meat. Has anybody ever heard that or said that before, perhaps? I really tried being vegetarian, but I really craved meat. And I said, no, you didn't. You weren't craving meat. And I said, no, I really was craving meat. And then when I had a hamburger, I felt really good, right? And I said, you were not craving meat. You were not craving the flesh of an animal. We are not obligate carnivores. We do not see animals grazing on the side of the road. That's not what happens. If you want to see what an obligate carnivore is like when they see prey, look at a domestic cat. Just watch a domestic cat for 5 minutes when they see a squirrel or a bird. They get really focused, and their eyes dilate, and they start to drool, and their tail starts to flicker, and they start to twitter. Is that what you get when you see a bird in your backyard? Is that what you get like? Do you get... I don't want to know if you do. Okay. but I'm going to guess that you don't get like that if you see cattle or deer or any animals that would be prey animals, right? We do not react that way when we see animals because we are not obligate carnivores. Even if we see an animal hit by the car, a car on the side of the road, the first thing we think is compassion, right? That's the first thing. I'm looking at people's faces. Some people have the look of disgust and some people have the look of compassion. Those are really the two reactions we have. Oh, we hope they didn't suffer, and oh my God, I don't want to see the insides of the animal, right? We don't take out our fork and start thinking about how to prepare that animal, right? So the point is that we do not crave the flesh of an animal, but we do crave things. We crave fat, and we crave salt, and we crave texture, we crave familiarity, we crave flavor. We crave a feeling of fullness. These are all things that we crave, and that's all legitimate, and all of those things can be met in plant foods. The problem is that our habits have made us go right to the things that we've all been taught to go to, the meat, dairy, and eggs, as opposed to, well, what am I craving? I want something fatty. I want something salty. I want something textured. I want something creamy, right? That's what I encourage people to do, is actually think about what the craving is and then meet the craving, as opposed to going right to the same habit that we're so used to going to. And all of those things are in pans. I mean, the fat, I mean, you know about the whole fats and the olives and the avocado and almond butter and peanut butter and nuts and seeds. I mean, there's so many ways to accomplish that. Putting guacamole on your burrito or avocado on your sandwich, right? Salt is an easy one as well when you're craving that. Part of the good news, too, about making the transition is that, again, I love the idea of the 30 days because the changes do happen that quickly, is you get the fat and salt out of your palate. And your palate changes too. So even the things that you think that you'll never stop craving or could never crave, and when people say this to you, I could never stop craving, give it a chance. Your palate really does change. I crave things, I didn't crave kale when I was growing up. I crave kale now. I mean, I never craved kale before, but I can't go a day without having kale. That's not what it was like when I first became vegan. It wasn't what I was like when I was growing up, for sure. Okay, not kale, wasn't craving kale. But your palate changes. So the flavors, I mean, you know, when people say that they, I'm just amazed. And a lot of this is just things that everyone's supporting each other saying. They're not really thinking about it too much, right? Well, vegan food, it's kind of bland. Don't you get sick of the same thing? It'd be bland. Bland? What do you put on your meat? What do you put on your hamburgers and hot dogs? You put ketchup and mustard and relish and onions and garlic and barbecue sauce and chutneys. Those are plants. You flavor your meat with plants because we are the only animal who has to flavor the animal we eat in order to make it edible. And we are the only animal who has to cook it to make it possible for us to not die from the pathogens in these animals. So we have to cook them, right? So the flavor is in the plant foods. The textures that we're craving are in plant foods, right? We want a chewy texture. I'm always amazed when people say, well, vegetarians who are eating fake meat, they say. Now, those who know me know I do not use the word fake. I do not use the word faux. I do not use the word substitute, alternative, mock, analog, anything that makes it sound like the animal products are the barometer by which we should measure everything else. It's not fake. I don't eat fake food. I eat real food from real ingredients. And in fact, the word meat originally meant that which was solid, that which was eaten, to distinguish it from that which was drunk. It just distinguished solid food from a beverage, right? We say coconut meat, we say nut meat. So I encourage people to take back the word meat and not use the word fake and say vegetarian meat, grain-based meat, nut-based meat, soy-based meat, whatever it is, but not fake and faux. And so those people who will say, well, vegetarians, they really want to eat animals. Why don't they just eat meat if they're eating the fake stuff? Why don't they just really eat it? They really want to eat animals. I didn't stop wanting to chew when I became vegan. I still want to chew, okay? So it doesn't belie some desire to want to eat animals. It just belies a desire to use my molars. I don't know. I just want to chew. So wanting to have something chewy, that's fine. And you can find that in mushrooms are wonderful. The thing that people love about mushrooms is the thing that some people hate about mushrooms, but they have that wonderful chewy texture, of course, and there's so many different kinds of mushrooms. But you can get that in so many different ways as well. Obviously, we've got our tofu. I talk about freezing tofu and how it changes the texture of the tofu completely and makes it wonderfully chewy. So I highly recommend that if you haven't tried that before with tofu and seitan and wonderful things, right? The feeling of fullness. I mean, all of these things we can still accomplish through plant foods, right? So does that make sense, right? Going, thinking about what the craving is and going for the meeting the craving as opposed to going for what our normal habit is. So when people start to contemplate this and they start to think, okay, well, I could do this, and I do want to eat more plant foods, and I do want to eat more vegetables, and I do want to become vegan, or whatever it is they say. Then they start saying, but then I'd have to chop some vegetables, and it takes forever to chop the vegetables, and they start whining about chopping vegetables, okay? I've heard the whining about chopping vegetables. The problem right now is that our threshold for chopping vegetables or spending any time in the kitchen at all is about zero. None. People don't want to spend any time in the kitchen because they just look at it as work. They don't look at it as an opportunity to nurture yourself and nourish your family and to enjoy that process as well. But I'm not expecting people to spend hours and hours in the kitchen. I mean, all of my recipes are about making whole, you know, whole, delicious, healthful recipes, but not spending hours and hours in the kitchen. So again, in 30 Day, I talk a ton about making the time to cook because everybody complains about not having the time to cook, right? I don't have the time to cook. If you have the time to get in the car and drive to a restaurant and wait for a table and eat your food and wait for the check and drive back home and find a parking spot in San Francisco, then you have time to chop some vegetables. Okay? So the problem isn't that we don't have the time. The problem is that we're not using the time we have. So I'm just suggesting we change the threshold to 15 minutes a day, which is not very much. And so again, I talk a lot about just planning in advance, chopping those vegetables before you put them in the refrigerator, because everyone looks at the carrots with their tops on and they look at the broccoli in the bunch or the cauliflower in the head and they go, and so they just don't chop them and then they leave them in the refrigerator and then they go, God, vegetables, they go bad. How do you stop them from going bad? My secret is to eat them. That's how you stop them from going bad, because you're not supposed to be having an experiment to see how long it takes for them to compost in your refrigerator. And then I hear people say, like, no, I figured out a way I can keep them fresh for like weeks and weeks. Why are you keeping vegetables in your refrigerator for weeks and weeks? You're supposed to be eating them. So whatever you can do to make them, you know, put them in a form to actually eat them. And I recommend people chop them in advance before putting them in the refrigerator. And as long as you're constantly doing that, when you come home from the grocery store, chop up some carrots, make florets out of that cauliflower and that broccoli, put them in a form so that when you open the refrigerator and you see them, you'll eat them. You'll throw them in a soup, you'll throw them in a stir fry. There's all things we can constantly do, right? So always planning in advance. If you're chopping an onion for a recipe, chop two onions. Chop one and put it in the refrigerator, chop one and put it in your recipe. So you're always thinking ahead. That's not time, that's thinking. So it's still not even time, right? When you're making a soup, make more. People said to me, people have requests of, you know, the books they want me to write. Could you write a book on this? Could you write a cookbook on for one person for living alone? No, I'm not going to write. Well, no, because I have other things I'm doing. But no, because if you're one person, I don't want you to cook for one person. You should be cooking for two. And if you're two, you should be cooking for four. You should always be making more so that you don't have to cook every day. Right? So planning ahead in terms of your meals, knowing the night before what you're having for dinner the next night. How many of us make the best decisions when we decide what to have for dinner at dinner time? When we're already hungry, when we're already starving, we're not making the most healthful choices. That's when we grab our frozen pizza or call the pizza guy or whatever, right? So knowing in advance what you're going to have the next night so that you can prepare again that morning for that evening. Okay? Does that make sense? So there's lots of things we can do, and a lot of it just has to do with changing our thinking. In the 30 Day Vegan Challenge, in every chapter, there's little boxes throughout that says challenge your thinking and change your behavior. So much of this is just changing the way we think about things. It's not even necessarily changing our behavior. Okay? And some of it's that too, of course, right? But a lot of it's just changing our thinking. So that's the food. The social aspects are a big element for people, and I talk about the social aspects a lot because I think for too long vegans have been too apologetic about living this incredible life. I mean, living compassionately, living healthfully. I think for too long we haven't used our voice to express the joy that comes from living this way. I've heard people say that they would be vegan, but they're afraid to kind of call attention to themselves. They don't want to stand out. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to call attention to themselves. And I get it for people who are shy, but the truth is, you know, we think we value individuality in this culture, but I think all of us are aware that we value conformity a lot more. Nonconformist is a dirty word in most people's vocabularies. And yet everybody says they want to make a difference, right? Everybody says they want to do something meaningful and live a meaningful life, affect change, do something meaningful. And I believe people when they say these things, but I wonder if these things mean as much to them as not appearing different. It's easy to go along with the status quo, but the question we have to ask ourselves is that what we want at the cost of our own values? And I know some of you have heard me tell this story before. I love this old Arabic folktale about a witch who comes into a kingdom one night, and she poisons the central well with 7 drops of a potion that drives people mad. And so all of the townspeople drink from this well, everybody but the king drinks from this well, and they all go mad. And the next day, they go to the king, and they accuse the king of being mad. And so now the king is faced with a dilemma. He could drink from the well, go mad, but stay in power. Or he could not drink, stay sane, but be swept from power by those who would view his very sanity as madness. And though the stakes may not be as high as in this story, I think they feel that way to many people. I think many people may not lose their kingdom, but I think they're afraid of losing their social status. They're afraid of losing friends. They're afraid of losing their comfort level. And all of these things may be valued as high to an ordinary citizen as a kingdom is to a king. Right? So it's easy to go along with the status quo, but we have to really ask, what's the cost? I've heard people say that they would be vegan, they would do it, or they do it sometimes, but they don't do it all the time because they don't want to make anybody uncomfortable, which sounds really noble on the surface. How noble of you to not want to make anyone else uncomfortable so that you don't reflect your own values, so that you don't upset anybody else. I don't get this. Because this is it. This is who we are. This is who I am. Anybody who knows me knows where I stand on certain issues, namely that animals are here for their own value, not here for my pleasure. That's not something I have to apologize for. That's not something that changes according to who invites me to dinner or who it might make uncomfortable. And the truth of it is, I think that notion is incredibly self-centered. Who am I to know how someone's going to react? Who am I to deny them the chance to show me that they care about me by saying, I'm vegan, and them saying, oh, I've been wanting to be vegan, I've had questions, I don't feel well, I love my animals, I don't want to hurt anybody. Can you help me? Can you answer some questions for me? I've never seen people at their most beautiful than when I say I'm vegan and they say, I want to cook for you, can I make a meal for you? I've been making more vegan foods. That's their choice. And I always appreciate it, but I think we underestimate our friends, and I think we underestimate our family members and coworkers, and we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. Because as much as we think we're protecting them from their own discomfort, we're also denying our own ethics, and we're also perpetuating violence against animals, but we're also potentially denying them their own transformations. Because how else does that occur but through that honest interaction and communication with one another, right? And what a mess I would be if my behavior were continually determined by how it would make another person react. I mean, my God. In other words, if my being vegan does make someone uncomfortable, that's not mine. That's not mine to do anything about. I didn't set out to make them uncomfortable, but we know what it's like when we just show up and say, I'm vegan, and someone says, whoa, and the hostility and the defensiveness. I didn't set out to do that. That's not mine. What someone does with my own values is not mine to worry about. Now, that doesn't mean that we be ungracious and rude or demanding, but it does mean that we need to speak our truth without being attached to how that truth will affect another person. And as much as we underestimate others, I think we also play small. I think we let fear guide us, and the lies that we're told become the lies we tell ourselves. One of the lies that we tell ourselves all the time is that it's too hard. People aren't going to change. It's too hard to change. People aren't going to stop eating animals. It's too hard to change. Now, you can call me crazy, because I know it sounds crazy, but I have more faith in people than that. I know people change. I see it every single day. I see people change. The problem is the more you keep telling people it's too hard to change, the more they're going to believe you. The more we keep telling people that there's something radical about eating fruits and vegetables and nuts and grains and mushrooms and beans and herbs and spices, the more we keep telling people that there's something extreme about not eating those mutilated bodies and stolen secretions of non-human animals, the more we keep telling ourselves these things, then nothing will change. The less we'll expect of ourselves, the less we'll expect of others, we'll keep that bar low, and nothing will change. But if we raise that bar, and we have some expectations of each other, and have some expectations of ourselves, then we see amazing things take place. Amazing things take place in order to empower people to really make that difference, to make the difference they say they want to make. And people ultimately ask me that, if I really feel that people can make a difference, do you really think that people can make a difference? And my answer is no. I don't think people can make a difference. I know people do make a difference. Everything we do, everything we buy, everything we eat has an impact on someone or something else. We don't get to decide whether we can make a difference or not. We get to decide only if the difference we inevitably make is negative or positive. That's it. Those are our only two choices. There are no neutral actions. And so for me, being vegan is about living my life with integrity and compassion, and doing everything I can to not contribute to violence against anyone, animals, non-human animals, human animals. It's about creating joy and meaning in a world so filled with violence, so filled with despair. That is to say, whereas violence creates more violence, non-violence also creates more non-violence. And I like being on that side of the equation. So all I ask people is never say never. Just be open and embrace the journey that comes with being human, the journey that encourages us to make new choices, to try new things, to make better choices, more compassionate choices once we know better. Because what I know for sure is that the problems we have in this world are not because people are living so compassionate. We don't have so much compassion we don't know what to do with it. That's not the problem. The problem is not that you're too compassionate. Just calm down with the compassion. See? The problem is that people are not living according to their own values of compassion and kindness. Most people say these are values they have. The question is, are they reflecting these values in their everyday behavior? And so that is my hope. My hope is that we will live each day and in all of our choices reflect our deepest values and know that we have the power to create the world we say we want to have and to be the people we say we want to be. And may it be so. Thank you very much. Thank you. Do that. I can't whistle. Thank you. We have some time for questions. If you have any questions, we do have a few minutes. We actually have about 10 minutes. Yes. Okay.
I've never heard you speak before, but you are everything I've heard you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So I have a question. When you explain different lifestyles and you explain how the vegan lifestyle seems so much more organic and sensible, it does. So how did the big lie get started? Mm-hmm.
It's a good question. So he's saying, okay, so you know, you make a good argument for the vegan lifestyle being the most natural. It feels that way. It feels right. It sounds right. It sounds good. But how did this big lie get started? You know, it goes back about 10,000 years ago. And I really do think everything shifted for us as a human, as a species, when we really moved into the agriculture age. I think the mindset of believing that nature is here for us to control still lives with us today. Because the problem for me in all of this is that we think that animals are here for us. And it's that mindset that enables us to do anything and everything we want and want to them and can to them, right? So I think so much of it has to do with that idea that that they're here for ours to take, they're here for ours to make our entertainment, they're here for us to exploit, they're here for us to take the reproductive system and control them in every way. So, you know, what happens when, I mean, a lot is affected by that, both from a species level, but also individually. And then what you have is this romanization, this complete romanticization, romanticization, what is the word? Romanticizing of agriculture. just romanticizing of agriculture, period. So we have this great romanticizing of agriculture, and then what you have are all of the industries who are going to get on that and make sure that we're supporting that as much as possible. I mean, so you could probably trace back the modern lies to, you know, to post, you know, around the war when they were pushing the meat, dairy, and eggs on people and supporting farmers and trying to get all of the meat, dairy, and eggs into people. And it really started then. And so many of the laws that we have today can really be traced back to then. And it continues, because the problem is that our government and the USDA, who's there to actually promote agricultural products, is also the one making the nutrition guidelines. There's a real conflict of interest there, and that's a real problem. So a lot of it has to do with that, kind of the mindset of agriculture, and then the government being so involved in agriculture and trying to also give nutrition standards at the same time. So we can do a lot. I mean, that's what's so exciting. And I think the idea that we actually have the power to do something for ourselves, for the animals, for our health, is really empowering for people, and it's also really scary for people. I think knowing that we have the power is really scary for people too. And so my hope is that people will really feel and find their voice so that they, again, feel unapologetic about living this way and pushing back and really stretching those boundaries and really making a difference. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I do recommend Jim Mason's book, An Unnatural Order, which, gosh, I hope it's not out of print now. Someone told me recently that it was, but you can find it somewhere, An Unnatural Order by Jim Mason. It was a really pivotal book for me in my understanding of all of that as well. Thank you. What's that? And World Peace Diet, of course. Will Tuttle talks a lot about that in the World Peace Diet as well. Absolutely, yes, absolutely. I adore Will. Yes. Thank you.
The thing is, something I run into a lot is, you know, you're standing at the at work at the banquet or something, you're filling up the plate, people look at it, and they're like, are you vegan? And say yes, and then they start to talk about how their doctor made them go back on meat, or their doctor made them, and I don't want to say your doctor's an idiot with no nutritional training. You have these great answers. You think, what's the great answer for somebody who's like, well, I felt terrible, and I went to my naturopath, and they said eat meat, and within 24 hours, I was revived. It's like, what do you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so did everybody hear that question? So what do you do when you're standing in line? You know, I like the idea of you're filling up your plate with vegetables. I do everything I can to make sure that I get the question, are you vegan? Oh, funny you asked that. How'd you know? I do everything I can to make sure they know that. So what do you say when they say, well, I was vegan, or I tried being vegan, or I was vegetarian, but my doctor said I need to go back to eating meat, or my naturopath, or, sorry, I keep doing that. What do you say to these people? Now, it's very difficult, right? Because we're in this position where the onus is on us to defend it, right? Not on them, to defend eating animals and doing all of these destructive things to their health and to the animals and to the environment, etc. The onus is on us, right? And so now we have this 7-second moment to answer what we hope is the best answer to get them to think differently. That's a lot of pressure. Okay, so I just want to just acknowledge that that's a lot of pressure. One thing I do recommend people do, and not especially when you don't have that much time to really have a thoughtful conversation with someone, is to ask questions and not always feel that you have to have the right answer. So I would probably say to that person, well, what was wrong? How did you feel? And they might say, well, I was tired. Well, gosh, you know, tired, that really has to do with calories, you know, not getting enough calories. Perhaps maybe were you eating enough? Well, you know, I was eating, I don't know, but maybe I wasn't eating enough. As you start to kind of probe, they start to ask themselves questions they've never asked themselves before, and often they wind up finding the answers themselves. So asking questions, I think, is a really good tactic when you don't have a lot of time. And then also, I think it's worth just saying, doctors do not have, you know, they're not trained in nutrition. I mean, I think, you know, but I understand it's also problematic, because then when they go to who are the alternative, health practitioners, and I will say that I find a lot of naturopaths and a lot of acupuncturists do recommend eating animals, and I find it very difficult sometimes. But they're also not the experts. I mean, it's, you know, so it's really a matter of we wind up finding the people who want to justify what we really want to do. So I don't know if that helps, but I think asking them questions back, because I really believe the answers are inside of them, they just need to be kind of pushed in that direction. You don't have to have the answer yourself, but just exploring it with them, because I think it also makes a really nice interaction. They don't feel that you're, you know, you've got all the answers, which frankly doesn't always go well if you think you do have all the answers, and then you also don't feel like you have to have all the answers. So it's kind of just a short little tip that I think helps a lot. Does that help a little? Yeah.
Historically, have there been more, less indefensible reasons for eating animals or animal products in, you know, earlier stages of development, you know, agricultural processes and such. I mean, you know, now you hear about factory farming and things. But I think people imagine that now food is more like it was. I guess what I'm asking is, was there a time hundreds of years ago when eating animals or animal products was less indefensible,
okay.
More practical?
Okay. So the question is, was there ever a time when eating animals and their products was less indefensible? In that, was there ever a time it was okay? Because today we have factory farming, but was there a time that it was less indefensible? And is there a possibility for there?
I mean, nutritionally and in terms of compassion.
Yeah, nutritionally and in terms of compassion. You know, going back to what I said about that mindset, you know, for me, factory farming is the effect of a mindset that says animals are here for us. That's just the effect of it. The cause is that we believe they're here for us. And the cause is the violence that is inherent in turning live animals into butchered bodies. That's what ritual is. That's what prayer is. That's what all of that is. From thousands of years ago to now, is trying to feel better about doing something that makes us really uncomfortable. So do I think there was ever a time that we felt really good about it? No, I don't. I mean, we know now that we were more gatherer-hunters than we were hunter-gatherers. Doesn't mean we didn't eat animals, I get that. I get that there was a survival aspect, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the excuses that we make to justify doing something that we don't need to do. And so once you're not comfortable with something, then you start to create the romanticizing and the ritualizing and all of that. To me, the bottom line is, you cannot get away from the violence inherent in turning that animal. Everybody will tell you, who grew up on a farm, who used to do it themselves in the most natural way, that they have to desensitize themselves in order to do that. Because it's really hard to kill. It's really hard to kill someone. Death does not come easy to someone who wants to live. They fight for their lives, and it's really ugly, and it's really disturbing, and it's really upsetting, and it's really bloody, and no one will tell you that feels really good. They will tell you that it was hard at first and then it became easy. That's called desensitization. And so I think that's the process that most people have gone through and continue to go through when they romanticize it. Nutritionally, same thing. We used to just eat so many more plants than we did animals. I don't think you have to defend it as much when you're not eating it as much. Right now, people are just, we're eating so much of this stuff. 10 billion land animals a year are killed in the United States alone, that I think that compels people to hold on to it even tighter. So personally, I don't think so, and I certainly don't think that's going to be, you know, that's the direction that a lot of this is going into. That's the problem when you make factory farming the main topic, is that, okay, well, we're opposed to factory farming too, so we're going to start slaughtering animals in our backyards. And by the way, I'm part of a group in Oakland called Neighbors Opposed to Backyard Slaughter, and if you'd like to come over to my table and sign a postcard to stop people who want to kill animals in their backyards in urban settings, please come over to my table to do so. I'd really appreciate it. Yes. What do I say to someone who says, "What blood type are you? You need to eat meat." I say, "Bye bye." I don't. It's bull. I don't. It's yes. I say that is bull. Period. Bull crap. Yes.
Thank you.
That's really, I'm really sorry. That's really, it's so insensitive. She was in a class, a bird drawing class, and the teacher said something about talking about the breastbone of the bird and said, sorry, vegans, the breastbone is the juiciest part of the bird. And that's so insulting. It's just so insensitive. And so the question is, what do I do? Can I do something? Can I do something? You know, I really believe intention is everything. And I believe you have to just be really clear about what you want to get out of it. If you want to continue going to the class and you still want to be comfortable there and you feel confident that you can do so if you say something, then do it. But you have to be really clear about your intention. I really talk a lot about not being attached to what the other person does with the information I give to them. So if your intention is to purely say, I found that really insensitive and I'd appreciate it if you would be more sensitive to those of us who do care about animals. Thank you. I still love your class, and I want you to know that that was that was probably more insensitive than you realized, or that hurt me, or I was hurt by that. If you want to communicate that, absolutely. If you want to give her a book, fine. But just not being attached to what she's going to do with that afterwards, I think is really important. So I think being really clear about what you want to get out of that will be helpful. I'm sorry about that. Yes. On the raw movement? I hate it. It's ridiculous. I'm kidding. My God. I don't have an opinion on the raw movement. I mean, people ask me how I feel about it. I mean, I want people to eat more vegetables. I want people to eat more raw vegetables. I, you know, probably eat 80-20 in the summer because that's what feels right for me in the warmer weather. And in the colder weather, I eat about 50-50 because I love soups, etc. But I know people really thrive and feel really good on it, and that's fantastic. But I don't have really an opinion on, you know, I have no opinion. That's really surprising. That's, I've never said that before. Yes.
One of the things that I have found very difficult is when you start talking to people about why you want to be a vegan or what it's about for you, there's an automatic defensiveness, like you're making judgment on their morals or their values.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I absolutely know what you're saying. She has difficulty because as soon as you say you're vegan, that immediately brings up defensiveness. And what do I do to create the open dialogue? So I'm going to end with this because this is we're out of time. I know the next speaker has to come in. But I talk a lot about this in my podcast. I talk a lot about this in 30 Day Vegan Challenge because it goes back to what I was saying before, that all I can do is speak my truth and know what my intention is, that when I'm speaking to someone, my intention is to speak my truth, to be a voice for animals, and that's it. Just to be their voice and to tell the truth and to tell my story. Because if someone says, why are you vegan? I think the most powerful answer is, what's your story? Well, I'm vegan because I feel really amazing not contributing to violence. I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to contribute to a system that is inherently violent and creating a violent culture. No one can tell me that that's wrong. Nobody can tell me that my story is wrong. Right? They can't argue with that. So telling your story, I think, is really powerful. But I'm also clear when I talk to that person that I don't have an agenda beyond being that truth and being that voice. And that, just the energy alone affects the dialogue because they won't feel that you have something that you want to get out of that conversation. It relaxes them and it relaxes you to actually have a dialogue. But that's where I'm saying you have to be really clear. If it does upset them, that's still not yours to do anything about. But I would bet if you changed your thinking about that person and there isn't judgment there, that the dialogue goes a lot smoother because they can feel it on that level as well. So tell the truth. Just speak the truth. Just speak the truth. And that's what will allow us to have conversations with people. So check out the podcast, check out the, my book, 30 Day Vegan Challenge. I can talk to you afterwards. I don't want to wait for the next speaker coming in because I know they're going to have to come in here. And thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate it. Thank you.